Change and Uncertainty conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, you will need to press the 1, followed by the 4 on your push-button phone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, April 29th, 1998. I would now like to turn the conference over to Mr. Bruce Davidson, Corporate Manager, Employee Assistance, and WorkWise Programs. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Matt, and good afternoon, everyone, and good morning to those on the West Coast. Thank you for joining us for this teleconference on taking care of yourself during times of change and uncertainty. And that certainly, for some of us, could be an understatement in regards to what is going on in the company and what many of us are experiencing that is constantly changing from a day-to-day basis. What we know is that every business is impacted differently as we look towards our merger between Compact and Digital, and certainly joining Tandem Computer that joined Compact. I want to clarify a few things about today's teleconference. This program will not cover or answer any questions that you may have about the merger, but we will focus on how we all react to change, and particularly during periods of high uncertainty. We want to look at the strategies for how we can all take care of ourselves during that process, and looking at different ways that we can become resilient and to build some resiliency to the various changes that we're all going to anticipate over time. But we certainly recognize that all this varies from region to region, site to site, and business to business as we all take a look into the future. Here in Maynard in the conference room, we have with us Alice Friedman. Let me introduce the people with us. Alice is manager of seminars at Work Family Directions, which is Digital's vendor for our Work Family services. She's located in Boston, and Work Family is a leading provider of corporate work-life services. Since coming to Work Family Directions, Alice has been developing seminar curricula, videos, publications to assist employees in over 130 major corporations that Work Family deal with on a regular basis. She joined Work Family Directions in 1989. She's been involved in providing stress management workshops and seminars for groups including the Boston Police Department. She has a bachelor's degree from Boston University and a master's degree from Boston College. And on the personal note, she's married, is the mother of two grown children, and has one grandson, which the last time Alice was with us was anticipated but hadn't arrived yet. Sitting next to Alice is Libby Michaud. She comes here with an education background, which is very important in helping us understand many of the factors related to change and uncertainty. She has taught in the elementary school systems and in high school, working with special needs children and regular students. She has an extensive experience in both step parenting and divorce. At Work Family, she is a counselor, a member of our digital team, and Libby has a bachelor's degree in sociology and a master's degree in elementary education. Also with us is Peter Goldring. Peter has a master's degree in social work, formerly worked on the digital team with our employee assistance program, and has been in the mental health field for over 25 years. He is currently in private practice and has a special expertise in dealing with stress reduction, anger management, and forensic psychology. Well, I'm excited about our ability to kind of get at this material and to begin to struggle with it. Clearly, when you look at newspapers, never mind when you see digital on the headlines, you see each week that we have mega mergers, companies acquiring each other, divestitures, and people coming together, everything geared towards a competitive edge or increased market share, and certainly what is hoped to be an improved stock picture, certainly from the business side. But without a doubt, these kinds of things create an enormous amount of anxiety and disruption for the employees involved. And a high degree of uncertainty during the initial phases in which two organizations are going to find a way to come together. Alice, what is going on?
Well, what you're saying, Bruce, is absolutely correct. A day doesn't go by when somebody doesn't hear or say the word change. And you were right on target when you spoke about all the shakeups in corporate America that have taken place during the last few years. And they have caused us to think about change in a whole different way. As a matter of fact, Ben Franklin, who was known for saying that there were only two things in life that were certain were death and taxes, now, if he lived today, would have added change. And change is really what life is about. We face it every day in our personal lives, and now we can certainly count on facing it in our professional lives as well. If Ben Franklin were alive today and worked in a corporation, he would probably say today, business as usual is business as unusual.
That sounds like that is here to stay. What does it mean for us?
Well, I guess that basically this means that the situation really is asking a lot of employees. They are expected to manage changes that are going on internally and externally with their corporations while they still have to work at getting the work done. And they have to manage the work while getting through the change itself. So it seems to me that probably the most important step to take is to adapt what I call a 1990s new millennium mindset. And part of that is understanding that we really have to raise our own bars of tolerance. We have to become more tolerant of things that are changing. And part of that is to acknowledge that this is the reality, to realize that this is the way things are, they're here to stay, and to really work hard at practicing to align ourselves with this truth. And that means becoming an ally of change, tolerating it, learning to live with the notion that ambiguity and uncertainty is really the norm.
I've heard one philosopher say that the art of progress is to preserve order amid change and to preserve change amid order. Most of us just want things to stay the way they are and the way we're used to having them. Most of us really don't like living in an atmosphere of total uncertainty or during the anxiety of uncertainty. Normally, when people are dealing with change, you've got a sense of the vision, what things are going to look like. Well, right now, in the course of the journey that we're going through in the business cycle right now, for many businesses, it's not clear what the next vision is going to be. We know it's going to change. We know things will look enormously different. And some businesses may look very much the same. But it's during that period of uncertainty that we're all struggling with. So how do you develop a 1990s mindset?
Bruce, it's a very interesting question. How do you do that? I think involves asking yourself certain questions to start with, certainly as it relates to change. I think one of the questions that we all ask ourselves is, what can we control? What can't we control? It seems like a very simple question, but I think it's quite complex, actually. When we're facing change at work, we're also facing change at home. It's useful to think about what we can control and what we can't control, focusing your energy on the word control. I'd like to ask all of you some questions from the pamphlet to think about and to give us some feedback about what you think you can control and what you can't control, keeping in mind the following questions. What's a challenging situation that you're facing right now? List the factors that are mostly beyond your control. List the factors that are mostly outside of your control. List the factors that are within your control. List the strategies that you can use to better manage the situation. Now, I'd like everybody to think about this for just a few minutes, and we're open to some feedback here.
Yeah. One of the things that we did was, for many of you, you probably received an email yesterday that included some of the handouts in your packets, and what Peter's talking about is a particular exercise within your packet. As Matt talked about, if you would like to contribute to the conversation, just press 1-4 on your touch-tone phone, and that will indicate to Matt that you'd like to contribute with a comment about this section. But as Peter's talking about, one of the critical areas is the whole area of control. And what we'd like to do is hear from a couple of you around some of the areas that Peter just talked about. What are some of the challenges that you think you're facing? And perhaps some of the things that you think are out of your control.
From Colorado Springs, please go ahead with your question.
Hi, this is Johnny in Colorado Springs. And I would like to ask, I guess what I'd like to say is some of us are in a position where we are very nervous about the merger and that we might be getting laid off. And I know that we're not talking about the merger, but the layoff possibilities are certainly a concern of mine. And I need some help dealing with that. I think the the merger and going forward is a good thing for us. But I think this little piece of it is especially powerful for me.
How much in control do you feel about that?
I feel like I have no control over it at all.
Well, you really have no control over whether that will happen or not, because that will be decided by circumstances and people that are beyond you. But you have control over what you can do to prepare yourself should that come about. And I think that it's pretty obvious today that all of us realize that companies are no longer going to take care of us the way they had perhaps a decade ago, when we would be hired and that company would keep us on board for as long as we chose to stay there. But now we are responsible for our own employability. So one of the things you can begin doing is to think about your skills, your interests, your abilities, your talents, and figure out what you want to do with that, should there be a layoff. And certainly I hope there won't be, but you want to poise yourself just in case that will happen and be prepared for it.
Okay.
Is that helpful? And I mean, it's a little scary to think about that.
Yeah, it is really scary. Considering my age, too, is I'm getting close to 50, and that is also another concern.
Uh-huh.
But that's helpful, because I hadn't exactly looked at it in that light before, to think about something else that I might be interested in doing.
And keep in mind, as an older worker, you've had a lot of experience. You've been able to build a really rich resume, and there's a lot that you can draw upon. Also, I think that sometimes the older we get, in spite of what people say, the more flexible we can become, because we've been exposed to a lot of different life experiences. We've learned how to get through them. That's in your favor.
You've also developed what are called life skills. It's called survival skills also, and I think we minimize that. But I think that becomes crucial in time of change, to focus on the areas that we really do have a handle on for ourselves personally, that we can use professionally.
Okay.
And I think what Peter's also talking about is, as part of this little exercise, taking an inventory of those things that are within your control.
Uh-huh.
And focusing your energy on those things that you can manage in regards to what's going on with your work, your personal life, and whatever future plans or issues that you want to consider down the road. Let's take a look at whether we have any additional questions, Matt.
Maxine from Deering, please go ahead with your question.
I have two questions. First of all, Peter, can you send me your mailing address and your phone number? I'm at maxine.brooker.digital.com. And secondly, just to reiterate what the other person was saying from Colorado Springs, I guess it's Johnny, I feel like it's just a matter of time when I'll probably be laid off, and I'm not sure whether I should wait or should seek another job or should take another job at less pay just to have a job. It's really, really scary, especially when you're the sole support of your family. And I'm over 50, so it's very scary.
Well, hopefully, I think through this program, what we can do is try to provide you some skills and some means to begin to analyze your particular situation and to gain a little bit of control for yourself, so that the scariness that you're feeling doesn't begin to negatively disrupt your ability to tend to your family and your personal life responsibilities. And that's a delicate balance, but the reason for this program is to begin to get a handle around those issues.
I think the real bottom line here, Bruce, is there are three things basically that we can control. We can control what we think, how we feel about what we're thinking, and how, more importantly, how we behave with what's going on in our mind and around us. You can take certain information, overwhelm yourself with the fears, the anxiety, or you can refocus that energy into ways of constructively taking care of yourself.
So for this particular caller, her thoughts might be to begin to become more realistic and say to herself, this is a possibility. I might not like it. It's not what I choose, but it could happen. And then to begin to feel I can manage it. I've gone through things in the past. I know what I need to do. And then the behavior part would be to do the things that you need to do to get you to the next place. Now, I know this sounds very simplistic and tight, but basically, that's all that we can really do. And once we begin to control our thinking, our feeling, and our behavior, we feel we're in the driver's seat and we can manage much more effectively.
And I also think that change that isn't often chosen can often be seen as an opportunity. If, in fact, it feels like a risk, it may be something that, in the long run, is to your great advantage, that would motivate you and put you in a position to change something you might otherwise, because it's familiar, because it's safe, because it's stable, you've never chosen to take the risk. So in some ways, it's a forced risk, and all of the things that you can control in preparation of that could put you in a more comfortable feeling about the possibility of the change, and to see it as an opportunity instead of as a negative.
I think it's also very important in this process, because I think it's important to make this into a process kind of thinking, that the focusing becomes on your internal process. Because if you sit and watch the people around you, sometimes other kinds of feelings and thoughts can become very contagious and may take you in a direction you don't want to go. You may be feeling good inside and very directed, but watching the people around you, that may either upset you or reinforce your position. So I would really try to, I would suggest that people stay as focused on taking care of themselves as possible.
And also be aware that there are going to be other, as Peter said, that people respond differently to change, and negativity can be infectious, as can fear. And if you can stay focused in that strength of, you know, I can be responsive in a healthy way that's not going to be totally scary about this, and realize that your coworkers aren't necessarily going to have the same attitude as you have and not behave in the same way. And obviously, with that, you can also be supportive to those people who may, in fact, feel more fearful than you are. If you're fearful, to seek out support yourself with a more positive coworker than a negative.
Thank you.
Matt, anybody else with a comment?
Anyone has any further questions, if they'll press 1-4 on their push-button phone.
Well, why don't we plug along in the direction that we're going? This was a very good introduction to the complexities of the situation. I have another quote. I've been really searching for quotes and comments that really help frame some of this. For every exit is an entry somewhere else, which kind of gives you a sense of this movement, but also at the same time of the wish to hold on to the past. One exercise I remember some people doing, and I don't think we have time today, but people could do it, you know, in their office, is to jot down what situations they were in 10 years ago. If they were still with digital or with digital at the time, what the work situation was, what was happening. People remember the period of time of 86, 87, and 88, and then begin to reflect on the changes in the company between 89 through 93, 94, and 95, and then certainly since 95 to the present. And just take a second and look at those time frames in regards to the enormous shifting and changing within the company, and then begin to take a look at where you personally were at that time and what changed for you. Because oftentimes in the midst of the anxiety, we lose track of the different changes we've all gone through during different career phases in our lives and so forth. And we lose track of the fact that many of us have a lot of coping skills to be able to deal effectively with change. There are three components that we began to talk about in regards to change. And one of them, I think, is it falls into denial in the change cycle. From the initial shock of the change is going to take place, and then people fall into a denial. Is denial bad?
Bruce, I think denial has both a positive and a negative function. I think we traditionally think denial is all bad, but I think that there are aspects that are positive. Let me define denial. Denial is the refusal to acknowledge the truth of a statement or a fact. It's a time of shock and disbelief. People may think, why me, why now? How could this possibly happen to me? I can't believe it, it's not true. Certainly about the question earlier about being laid off, why me, not now. Much to, I think, all of our surprise, there's also a positive aspect of denial. I think the positive aspect of denial keeps the loss of the change at a distance.
It's sort of like a shock absorber.
Yeah, it's a shock.
It gives us time to take it in. because if we accepted the reality too quickly, it could be almost overwhelming. So when we're in denial, we're giving our bodies and our minds a chance to just absorb it slowly and to move to a point where we can begin to face it.
I think that's one thing that's bottom line about change, and it's an important thing to know about all of us, that we all have our own governor inside, mm-hmm. that only allows so much in so we don't just get completely overwhelmed. We may feel overwhelmed, but that governor in all of us takes care of us. So denial isn't all bad, Bruce. There is a very positive aspect. And I refer to coworkers. It's not about saying to your coworker, oh, you have to accept this or else. Mm-hmm. People will accept the change when they're ready.
Yeah. And I guess everybody adjusts to the cycle differently. Not everybody's going to be in the same place at the same time. But what does happen after the denial phase?
Well, after people get through that denial phase and are able to see the reality, they oftentimes enter a resistance phase. But I think what's interesting, and before Peter talks about that, I would just like to make a comment about the resistant phase. Most people look at resistance as being something negative. You know, they'll say, oh, that coworker is just being resistant, he's being inflexible, he's not accepting the change, he's not going with the flow. But in a way, that resistance is really very important, because that's the way that the individual can really preserve his self-esteem, his self-worth. That's the way the individual can protect his sense of mastery and his competency. So on the one hand, when we look at people and we see that they're being resistant and we might not think that it's helpful for them, we really ought to consider the value that it is providing that individual and then gently move that person out of the resistant phase.
Peter, what's some of the feelings that people can expect to experience that goes along during that phase of resistance?
I think a whole variety of feelings, Bruce. I think fear, anxiety, anger, resentment, guilt, hopelessness, helplessness,
confusion. Self-absorption, right? Life is dealing me a difficult situation. Why me?
Resentment,
anger.
Any others? Didn't think of?
My sense is once we get started, we'll fill a flip chart.
Right, yeah, right.
I'm afraid we might.
Well, and there are a lot of behaviors that are really the signs of resistance, even ones that are so subtle, like showing up for work physically but not really being there, not producing.
A lackadaisical attitude.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Being too busy to return a phone call, pointing the finger, blaming other people.
Or maybe just distracted.
Yeah.
Certainly, by everything. You know, it's interesting. Rosabeth Moss Cantor, who wrote, you know, a variety of different books, and one of them, which is called Change Masters, put together a short piece that really does take a look at why do people resist change. Let me take a minute and take a look at some of those. Peter, we've already talked about some of the factors associated with the loss of control, and really the difference in those factors that she talks about is whether or not things are being done by us are being done to us. Another factor is really excess uncertainty. And for many people in our audience, I think that the reality is that we may be going through a period of excess uncertainty, walking off a cliff blindfolded to the problem. That will vary, certainly, but I think it's a factor that Rosabeth Moss Cantor certainly brings out.
And you know, Bruce, when we are faced with the unknown, all we can do is really hold on to what we know.
That's right.
And that's perceived of as resistance.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I like to think of uncertainty as being on the fence, and most of us have a very difficult time being on that fence and not knowing which side we're going to fall down on or jump off of or go to. But it's a very positive learning piece of you know, being a human being is learning what are you going to do with, it's a lesson, really. What are you going to do with that uncertainty? If you accept it, if you just see, well, this is where I am right now, I don't know. There is the unknown, the uncertain is there, and what am I going to do with it? There's a great quote that I like. It's called, I don't even know who I'm quoting, but it's, resistance magnifies pain. And it's almost like the more you resist, instead of, you know, saying this is just the way it's going to be, and it's a question mark, and accept that it's a question mark, and that's okay. It's okay not to know sometimes.
And, of course, as Roosevelt says, continuing, you have the surprise factor.
I like that.
And as time goes on, one surprise after another that may, in fact, contribute to why someone may feel resistance. The difference effect, the fourth reason, as she talks about people resist the change, is the effects of difference. The fact that change requires people to become conscious of and to question familiar routines and habits. The other one can be people struggle with what she calls the loss of face. If accepting change means admitting that the way things were done in the past was wrong, people are certain to resist it. And sometimes people will personalize and view things in that way. Other areas quickly talk about concerns about future competence. Certainly we'll talk later in the show of the ripple effects in which we go through this change process and it starts to ripple into the home, into the family, and for some people with their children or partners. For some, it may mean more work. It may bring up some of the past resentments that people may have and past experiences that did go well. And lastly, sometimes it's felt, as we've heard from some of the callers, a belief that the threat may be real in some way. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other things that we see in terms of what resistance looks like?
You know, I think, Bruce, as I was listening to you speak about Rosabeth Cantor's explanation of resistance, I mean, it's clear that everything that she says is perfectly normal. And I think one of the messages that we want to get across in this teleconference is that the phases that people go through during the transition from the end of something to the beginning of something else are very normal and very natural. But the problem really occurs when people get stuck in one phase and can't move on to the next. And people tend to get stuck in the resistant phase because they might perceive themselves as victims having no control, or they might be so paralyzed by fear and anxiety that they can't move ahead. Or more importantly, the resistance phase can prevent people from being adaptable and from learning. I know Wayne Gretzky has a wonderful quote. He says when he skates, he always goes to where the puck is going, not where it's been. So I think clearly that's a signal for us to think about the fact that we don't want to stay stuck in a phase, but to keep moving, to go with the flow.
Alice, I've seen people, I think we all have, they get stuck in the resistance phase, specifically the loss phase,
yeah.
And respond to that in many different ways. But it's real.
It's painful.
It's scary. You know, people might lose some things here. They may lose power, as Bruce said, lose face, potentially money, home, self-esteem, mastery of their own work. There's a flip side to it, though. I mean, with change, who's to say that all that's going to happen and not something else? And the uncertainty is there, but what about the uncertainty moving towards the positive side?
Right, and there's an example that we have about, you think about a leaf, and it goes through cycles of it dies, it goes through that initial phase, and then it goes through the next phase, which is of that fallow time period in the winter where there's nothing, and then there's rebirth and growth and a new beginning. And so I think it's really important to normalize for the audience here that those phases or transitions or processes are all very normal, and as Peter and Alice have said, being able to move through them is the key, but also recognize that it's okay to be in one of those at some time, but not to get stuck in it. And that's the hardest part, because we don't like to let go of the familiar, the stable, the known, and moving into the unknown tends to be scary. And my new philosophy in life is if it feels like a risk, then you should do it. then it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
Then it is a risk.
Then it is a risk. You know, recognize it, that I'm afraid of this, I'm not comfortable with this. That's okay.
Libby, you're building in growth.
Right.
By taking that attitude.
Right.
And I think that's what it's all about. Whether you're 25, 50, or 75, it doesn't really matter.
And sometimes you're put into the position of having to grow without the choice. And sometimes we get to choose those risks. But in this situation that many of you are in, you don't necessarily get to choose this growth path. And that's where the control feels like it's not in your control. And that's where we're trying to help you see that there are pieces that you can. And a big piece is that attitude. of how you're going to look at the fact that things could change dramatically.
And sometimes you have to be out of control to get back into control.
Right, and it's okay.
Yes, exactly. And before we talk about attitude and thoughts, I think it's also helpful to mention the fact that people do tend to go through these phases in some predictable fashion. However, it's not uncommon to be in one phase one day and then go back to a previous phase another day, or even at 9 o'clock in the morning, you say, oh, I'm in the acceptance phase now. And then by 10 o'clock, you say, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this is really happening. And you find that you're really waffling back and forth. And that's perfectly normal. That's all part of the unknown.
Wait a minute, Alice. You're saying that we have to revisit some of these feelings and stages over and over again?
I think we do, as long as we keep breathing.
So we can't do, well, oh, good, I'm done with that one. Now I can move on to the next one?
There's an interesting quote. It says, strangely enough, this is the past that somebody in the future is longing to go back to.
That's right.
And in a sense, it does feel like a cyclic process in which in 1 minute we feel like we're moving forward and perhaps moving to the next phase, which is commonly called the acceptance phase or the commitment and understanding that we are moving to a new situation. And that begins to get into struggling and saying, well, before we go into the acceptance phase, there are some people who get very angry in this whole process. And I don't want to leave that out. That the resistance phase and you get through the shock and you're struggling with, do I want it? What's going to bring forward in the uncertainty for it is for some people a real sense of anger and frustration.
Right. And anger is really a secondary feeling or a secondary response, if you will, to another feeling. So people feel angry because they've been disappointed. They are rejected.
And they have certain, I think, expectations or perceptions of how it should be. I mean, I think we all set up in our little world that we decide, well, this is going to happen at this age, and this will happen, and we plan ahead, and we map out our goals and, you know, expectations, some of us. And when it doesn't work out that way, you get angry about it. This is not fair. This is not what I asked for. I didn't plan for this. And I think what happens is that anger affects us physically. And it's one of those emotions that, you know, either you are physically tightening your hands when you go to bed. I often find that when I'm in that mode of relaxing at home, if I pay attention to my hands, I often realize that they're in a fist. And I think, oh, if I just open up my hands, that will relax me. And simple exercises are available for people to be able to take and have some sense of control when that anger emotion comes into play. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. It's very simple exercise in that it's deep breathing, which the power of the breath is something that many, many areas of stress reduction take into account. And it can be from meditation to yoga to how you exercise to how you sit at your desk. But the breath is obviously something that we all have in common. And as soon as you make a connection to your breath, you have a relaxation effect. And I know it sounds pretty simple and basic, but that's exactly what it is. That when you feel angry, often we stop breathing, or we breathe more shallowly, or we don't exhale or inhale. And pay attention to that at times. If you start to feel angry about something, tune into what is your body doing. So you will see that your body, in effect, does the shallow breathing or not even breathing at all. I mean, I find I have quite a few children at home, and when I'm angry and I begin to shout occasionally, I find that I'm not really breathing when I do it. When I'm done, I have to take a deep breath because I've spent all this energy in my anger. So if you can accept that there's this power to the breath, it can help you center, focus yourself, relax yourself. And it's a very simple exercise at your desk, in your car, when you wake up in the morning, that as you are sitting quietly, if you can take the time to pay attention to your breath, where is it coming in through your nose and then exhaling it out through the mouth. And if you do that I'm not talking about 40 minutes a day or 20 minutes a day. If you take, you know, anywhere from 3 to 10 minutes a day to focus on the breath, And if you find yourself tense at work, you find yourself angry because your boss has just told you something or something's happening that's out of your control, pay attention to your breath. That's the time to pull your awareness to it. And as soon as you do, take a deep breath. Inhale, exhale. I have on my desk a vase that says breathe across it because I need that reminder. And there are many times that I find that that's an excellent resource that's there all the time whenever you need it.
You know, and research has really proven that this is highly effective, Libby, so I'm really excited about your mentioning this. Executives have undergone some of this deep breathing, and they have reported that after the sessions when they sat quietly at their desks, that they found that they were much more creative, they were much more open to new ideas, and much more flexible. Mm. So there is a lot to say in this. It's not just a hokey exercise.
Libby, I remember running a seminar some time ago with some very high-level people, and I walked in the room, and you know when you walk in the room and you can sort of cut the tension?
Yep.
And you know, you look around the room and you could see people's teeth being clenched and there were fists on the table and everybody was sort of glaring at each other. And I said, forget it. And I went over and I turned down the lights and I said, you're going to do what I tell you to do now. And I did this deep breathing exercise and it was hysterical. And when we were done, a third of the people, you know, their ties were loose. They were sitting back in the chair and they were smiling a little bit. About a third of the people were asleep. And there were a few who were still sitting at the table with the clenched fists staring into the wall. But sure. By and large, you know, taking a deep breath and counting to 10, which you probably have to do at home,
sure,
is such an effective way of taking care of yourself and getting a handle on, again, what you can control and what you can't control. Sort of brings up, sort of stepping back here for a second, anger is part of the resistance process. I sort of need to go back to that a little bit because the breathing is certainly a wonderful way of managing your anger. What is anger? Anger traditionally is a defense. We start running into trouble when we move it to our offense using the anger. Often we feel like we can protect ourselves, and what we end up doing is overprotecting ourselves. And so this is, again, another area where I think you can control with Libby's suggestion of just doing a little breathing. You've got to think about what battles you're going to fight in this world. And you fight the battles, you're going to win.
Do you think that often the anger, too, is a result of fear?
Oh, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. You know, who knows the story about the lion in the woods? About coming upon a lion in the jungle, and you have two responses, fight or flight.
Right.
And some people choose to fight the lion, and some people choose to run. But that's the internal automatic response.
Right.
For some reason, fighting the lion doesn't feel like a good survival technique.
No, I wouldn't think so, Bruce. I mean,
it
depends on your experiences, Bruce.
Well, I think we can fight the lion in a metaphorical way.
Without a doubt.
By doing what we need to do to take care of ourselves.
What role do our internal filters play in all this, Peter? And how we process our feelings through internal filters?
Well, going back to the lion, if we look at the lion and say, oh, this is no big problem here. This lion is really a kitty. And we this is called a distortion, by the way. And we decide to take on this kitty cat, we lose. But if we use our filters effectively, then we can sort of assess the problem and move forward in a way that we can take care of ourselves. But our filters sometimes really distort things in a way that are very harmful.
So what you're saying, Peter, is that the lion is really a neutral creature. It's neither good or bad.
That's right.
But it's our perception of it.
Precisely.
Which will determine our interpretation of it and ultimately our thoughts about it, our feelings about it, and our behaviors.
Without a doubt, our actions and behaviors. Yes.
Right. So basically, we can look at what's happening now at digital and say that it could be a neutral event because we could perceive it in many different ways. What happens is that when an event occurs, we take it in. Our brain takes it in through our eyes. And then there is that mental filter that you spoke about, Bruce and Peter, a moment ago. What that filter is really our mindset. It's a piece of our brain which determines how we're going to interpret situations. And that's based on our past history, what our childhood was like, the messages that we were given by our parents, by teachers, by bosses. And this will determine how we're going to interpret a situation. Now, oftentimes what happens is that we have certain assumptions about the way the world should operate. We have certain beliefs about the way corporations should run their business. And we also sometimes jump to conclusions about things. So going back to that lion, we could see that lion and think right away he's going to have us for his breakfast or his dinner or whatever. Or we might misinterpret the situation and make different kind of assumptions. The important thing, and I think, Peter, you alluded to this a moment ago, is to take that interpretation, which could be a distortion, and to correct it. And once we correct it, we're putting the control back in our hands. And we can then change the way we think about the situation, the way we feel about it, what our mood is going to be, and ultimately our behavior.
I'm sorry, Alice. Please. How do we know if we're distorting?
A good way to do that is to check with other people, to speak to your friends, to colleagues, or to really look at your own instincts and to try to separate the powerful feelings that you are experiencing from the event itself and to ask yourself questions. So, for example, one question you might ask is, will this be the worst thing in the world if something happens to my job? The answer probably is, I'm not going to like it. It's going to be a huge change for me, but I've gone this far with several jobs, and chances are I'll be able to find another one. Will it be the worst thing in the world if I'm transferred to another department? You might not like it, but then again, it might be the best thing in the world. There might be a lot of new opportunities. I think it's really about how we frame the events that we experience in life. If I may, I'd like to share a little story with you that I heard the other day. A man was living in a community, and he was the only person who had a horse. And he used the horse for helping him do his gardening, his crops, and for taking the crops into the marketplace. And all the neighbors came to him and said, "You are so lucky to have this horse." And then, lo and behold, one day, the horse ran away. And the neighbors came to him and said, "This is really sad. I'm sorry that you lost this horse. This is terrible." Next day, the horse returned with two wild horses. And all the neighbors came back and said, "This is great. This is great." And the man said, "Well, maybe." And he responded, "Maybe," each time the neighbors would speak to him. The following day, his son tried to ride one of the wild horses and tame him and fell off the horse and broke his leg. And the neighbors came back and said, "This is awful. This is terrible." And the man said, "Well, maybe." Then a week later, the country was at war, and soldiers came in to conscript some of the young men for the army. And the farmer's son was not taken because he had broken his leg. And all the neighbors came in and said, "Isn't that great?" So the point here is that it's how you look at things that will really determine what the outcome is.
So before we leap ahead into part two in terms of taking a look at perception, taking a look at how we see things and then lead us forward, because I think that's what we've been talking about, is the internal filters and how we interpret the situation or view the situation that is going to lead us to how we may be envisioning the next steps for ourselves and where we're going. Why don't we take about a 60-second break and while we switch tapes, but also allow you all to take some deep breaths and use that as an opportunity to relax, because my guess is that some of our conversation may have raised people's anxiety as compared to reducing it. So as we move into phase two, we begin to take a look at how we interpret our situations and move towards how we deal with problem solving and moving forward.